down a hallway, her mind racing, not even caring that she might be tracing blood. How is she to find William? Will he believe her story? Will he even remember who she is? She notices a faint fragrance coming from every direction, citrusy and fresh, as though the windows have been purposefully kept open, so different from the sweet floral musks preferred by the Delusian palace. "Yo there!" a female voice calls in a thick Arbinian accent, probably a servant. She's been spotted. The voice is about 50 paces away, likely at the very end of the long hall. Isby doesn't turn around.
"Stop!"
the woman behind her cries. She pushes open another door and stumbles into a room, slamming the door closed behind her. Then she is roughly shoved down and the air is knocked out of her. Someone is pinning her arms to the floor. He smells of fresh sweat masked by lime soap. "State your purpose if you want to live," the young man says. His voice is quiet, a tree in the wind, but his grip on Isby's arms is tense. She feels the vibration in his entire body and recognizes it. Fear.
"It would be easier to state my..." she huffs out, finally giving up.
The man rolls off her, taking his exotic lime soap smell with him. Isby heaves a deep breath. There's a rapid knock on the door and a woman's breathless voice comes through, the same servant who tried to stop Isby moments ago.
"An intruder, my lord!"
"I have it well in hand, Elise," he calls through the closed door. "You may return to your duties. Now tell me," he demands, turning his voice back toward Isby, "the name of the person so bold as to enter the chambers of the prince without invitation. And in your condition," he adds.
"I have been blind for 16 years. I'm quite capable of getting around in my condition," Isby declares, sitting up with effort.
"Actually, I didn't mean that," he says less roughly. "I meant your, well, the disarray of your attire, the hideous stench emanating from you."
He lifts her hand and then drops it again.
"The fingers nearly blue from cold. And there's the haphazardly shorn hair." He sucks in a breath. "Gods help me. Are you a woman?"
Insulted, Isby pushes a stray clump of soggy hair out of her face, feeling something wet streak her forehead. Blood, most likely. Then she remembers what she must look and smell like, her hair having been hacked short with a knife, and having sailed the open sea, nearly died, and then tunneled into the castle village via its sewage system, before bloodying her hand from a broken window. She crosses her arms over her chest.
"How'd you figure it out?"
"Your frame is much too small to be a man's. Your voice too high, your lips too delicate."
He is still sitting beside her on the cold marble floor, and she can feel the weight of his gaze on her, more intense than the weight of his body had been.
"I fooled the entire ship of sailors who brought me to your shores."
She feels a zing of pride when she says this aloud.
"And let me guess, you paid your way aboard this ship?"
"Yes, but..."
She stops. Could he be right? Were they just playing along, pretending to believe she was a boy and that Gil was her brother? Would the captain have simply given passage to anyone carrying the right amount of gold coins? Humiliation sweeps through her, heating her cheeks.
"Well," she swallows, "since you asked my name, it's Isabel, daughter to the late King Henri of Deleuze."
The man emits a sound that resembles a choke and a snort.
"What?"
He makes a sound again. It is, she's horrified to realize, a laugh.
"I've been through far too much to be made fun of now," she says, trying to steady the slight tremor in her voice.
She begins to stand, hoping her weakened legs won't wobble.
"I'm sorry," he says, his cloak giving a low, velvety swish across the floor as he stands too. "I'm not making fun of you, I just..."
There it is again, the laugh. She glowers. He clears his throat.
"So, Isabel of Deleuze, if that really is who you are, what did cause you to go through so much just to seek admittance to the prince? Did the Delusian Council send you? Because it certainly wouldn't appear so. And how did you possibly get across our borders? They've been closed to travellers from Deleuze for the past week, ever since news spread here of the..."
"Sleeping sickness, I know. I have my ways,"
she answers, not willing just now to explain that she nearly drowned and was saved, only to be unceremoniously dumped on an abandoned and reeking dock miles from the palace. And I will only explain why I'm here to the prince himself. Please, prove to me that you are in fact William of Arbin.
I must prove my identity to you, he asks with faint amusement. I could have you sent to the dungeons for the rest of your life for trespassing.
Give me your hand, Isby demands. She hears him hesitate, clearly taken aback by the forwardness of her request. But then, gently, he picks up her right hand and places it on his palm. She moves her fingers over his, feeling the strength and sturdiness of his hand before running her fingertips over his rings until she finds what she's searching for, the royal Arbinian signet. Satisfied, she turns her face toward his.
It is you.
How did you get here? He asks, sounding sincerely curious. The palace is quite well defended. If my castle guard is sleeping on the job, they'll be hearing about it soon enough. You've embarrassed a family and a nation, known for our caution.
I've lived in a palace all my life. I know my way around.
Well, you've made quite an impression.
She's not sure what to think of the comment, but once again she feels the weight of his gaze, and it makes her uncomfortable. She clears her throat.
We need to talk. I'm here to seek your... Well, she hesitates, realizing she should have planned her speech better. My kingdom needs your help. I need your help. You have to come with me back to Deleuze. At once. Now, in fact. We should leave today.
Travel to Deleuze? With you? That's ridiculous.
It's not ridiculous. This is an emergency. Deleuze is desperate. You're our only hope at the moment.
William sighs.
I'm very sorry, Isabel. Really, I am. The sleeping sickness sounds terrifying. I hate that Arbin has had to close its borders, but we can't afford a crippling plague when times are hard enough as it is. I really am very sorry indeed, but I don't see what I could possibly do to help.
Sorry indeed. Don't be an idiot, William. Don't act like you don't know that both our kingdoms are in danger. And I'm very sorry for the loss of your older brothers.
She feels a little bit bad about spitting out that last part.
But the responsibility to do the right thing for Arbin lies in your hands now. I hope you don't intend to let your kingdom fall to Malfleur.
Ah, so this is a political visit.
What else would it be? I'm not here for a hot cup of tea.
No, the prince says, that gentle swaying tree sound back in his voice. You are certainly not.
I'm here to talk about how our countries can help each other in a time of great peril. The threat of Malfleur is real, no matter how much you'd like to deny it.
I don't deny it, he says, pacing. Arbin has long suspected Queen Malfleur's dissatisfaction with the Lamorte territories. We've been anticipating a move on her part for years. But that doesn't mean I'll help Deleuze.
This surprises Isby. Her impression, both from her palace as well as her brief time in the country at Rule's home, has left her believing that the majority of people doubt Malfleur will ever organize, and certainly most of them don't know what Isby knows.
If you agree with me that the Fairy Queen is a true threat, then how can you conscionably refuse to help? Who do you think will be next if Deleuze falls? Once she has all our gold and our caverns of wine, what do you think she'll come for? The sunny shores of Arbin, that's what.
Perhaps, William says. But unlike Deleuze, we have weapons. We're prepared for war. Deleuze, on the other hand, is fattened with wealth and pride, lazy, ignorant, and massively divided by infighting. Your people are unhappy, your military wildly disorganized, and now a devastating disease is sweeping through the aristocracy, beginning at the very top. An alliance would be imprudent at best, and more likely doomed.
Isby feels as though she has been punched in the jaw. She is floored by this account of her kingdom. The sting of his assessment is made worse by the faint taste of truth in it. She blinks rapidly, trying to regain her composure. She needs to try a new tactic.
Malfleur's people killed your brothers. Isn't that enough to incite vengeance?
That portrait of the situation is only one view.
What do you mean?
Isby feels her face getting hot with frustration.
We have every reason to suspect that Deleuze, and not Lamorte, is responsible for the murder of my brothers, William says,
his words hard as stone on stone.
But I... why?
Because your kingdom doesn't want this alliance any more than ours does. If you really think your royal council is acting in the general interests of the populace, then you are wrong. It seems I know what the Delusian peasantry wants more than you do, Isabel. They are sick of seeing the lavish waste of the upper classes while they work and suffer. She swallows hard.
And Arbin's peasants are living in luxury, I suppose,
she asks, sweeping her arms around to indicate the decadence of the room, though even as she does, she realizes that from what she's observed so far, this palace is in fact far less furnished, decorated and perfumed than the Delusian palace.
No, William admits. But we lead by example. We have strict regulations that all nobility must adhere to.
We make public accounting of all our taxations. Our kingdom is lean and efficient. Our expenses go toward weapons and military, not superfluous indulgences.
But Deleuze is constantly exporting goods to Arbin.
Oils, metals, essentials, not spices or silks. She can't argue with him. She doesn't know enough about Delusian trade to assess whether what he says is accurate.
Even if you're right, you're still not going to be able to save yourselves from Malfleur if the information I have is true.
And what information is that?
The sleeping sickness is the work of the Fae. Dark fairy magic, William. Meant to cripple us, just as Malfleur launches her plots to overtake us. And that means closing the borders won't help. The sickness is not a typical disease of nature, but the result of a curse. It will come for you too, all of you, unless we work together to stop it.
And how do you propose we do that?
He seems to be really listening now.
I know how to undo the curse, she says.
He says. It's his thinking noise, she realizes.
A fairy curse. You must realize how this sounds. The Fae have been dormant for decades. Most could not abide by the laws laid down by my father's father and have long since left Arbin. Those that haven't died out, that is. I've never heard of one having the power to curse a nation and cause a disease.
You have to believe...
That said, the prince goes on, cutting her off. If what you say is true...
It is! I know it is! Malfleur cursed Aurora, my sister, to die on her 16th birthday. Then the fairy duchess, Violette, amended the curse, saying she wouldn't die but would fall into a deep sleep, only to be awakened by true love. As far as I can gather, my father and his wife made every attempt to cover it up, and the Delusian Council is complicit in hiding it. They saw it as an irredeemable scandal, one they clearly wanted to keep hidden from the people and, even more importantly, from Arbin. And now almost everyone in attendance at her christening is dead or asleep. But Violette said true love would awaken Aurora. And that's where you come in.
You think I'm Aurora's true love?
I think you can be. I don't know how much about the Fae except that their curses are not always as literal as they seem. And I have to try. I have to try. If you come help me, and if you succeed in awakening my sister, it will send a signal to Malfleur that we can stand against her magic.
The prince is quiet for a moment.
But what if we can't?
So you do believe me, then?
Isby asks, relief flooding her, bringing in a new wave of energy.
He says.
Let me ask you something, Isby says softly. If you had a chance to bring back your brothers, would you try?
His laugh this time is curt and hard, a door slamming.
The answer to that is complicated. My brothers, they weren't very kind.
Isby doesn't know how to respond to that. It's not at all what she was expecting him to say. All the hope she felt moments ago shrivels like a dried leaf. He doesn't believe in fairy magic. He doesn't believe the sleeping sickness is a curse, or that he could possibly play a role in undoing it. He isn't going to help. She's come all this way. She's lost Gil and risked her own life. And for what? Her mouth feels dry. She licks her lips. They are chapped and sting. Her whole face is chapped, in fact. Her skin stretched dry from the salt and the freezing wind. Her body aches. She's still cold and wet and horribly reeking. And her hand stings from her cut. Her head hurts. Despair pushes down on her, making it difficult to stay upright. She needs a chair. Why is there no chair? She sways slightly, trying to think, trying to figure out how to save this. But she can't think. Not anymore. Gilbert is gone. Aurora is asleep, maybe forever. And Deluce, just as the prince said, is doomed.
Isabel, I do believe that Malfleur intends to go to war, and that our kingdoms are mutually endangered. Though her soldiers, if they mean to take the Delusian palace, will first have to survive the sickness, which may in fact buy us some time. Still, I will hear no further political entreaties until you have done one thing for me.
Isabel swallows. And what is that? She's been through so much. She's afraid this last request will be the one that kills her.
For the love of all things decent, I insist you have a bath.
It is late now. She is alone. The night guard is quiet enough that she can hear the scampering of mice in the corners of the halls, the fluttering of bats in the courtyard, the lone coo of an owl searching the dark, its hunger as yet unsatisfied. She can hear almost the settling of sheets around sleeping bodies, the scuttling of the palace baker preparing for the next day's meals, the hum of snores. And even more faintly, more impossibly, comes a sweet voice from her mother dreams, twisting the lyrics of the rose lullaby like vines around her heart. The prince informed only Elise, one of his most trusted servants, to draw and heat the water and to provide fresh clothes before leaving Isby to disrobe. No one else knows of her presence. Hundreds of fresh cuts and scrapes cry out silently as Isby lowers her sore, tender limbs into the bath through a cloud of citrus-scented steam. But gradually, the chill begins to recede from her bones. Her nakedness makes her feel even more alone, and she sinks lower, until the water comes up to her chin and ears, to the tips of her shorn hair. This bath is going to make her smell like William. She clutches her wounded palm and thinks of the prince's premonition about Malfleur. Thinks of how readily he said it. War. The word moves through Isby with a tremor. She spent much of her youth spying on military drills and has always fantasized about fighting for a cause, maybe even dying for one. Gilbert always said she was crazy to want that. The heat seeps into her, thawing and unlocking feelings she doesn't want unlocked. She can't think about Gil. Not now. She holds her breath and goes under. Beneath the surface, her ears ring, and she is back on the ship, crossing the sea, listening to the high whine of the harpoon's taut rope just before it snapped, remembering the hope that flew into her even as she was tossed into the frothing waves. She thinks of the clamor of the men as they grabbed for spears, as they flung their weapons wildly at the majestic, crying beast, wanting the giant body for its blubbery, pungent oil, and the high value they could charge for its tusk. It pierces her chest, sharp as the tusk itself, the unfairness that one life must sometimes be sacrificed to save another. She comes up gasping, her hair dripping warm, soapy water down her shoulders. If this is what it means to be a true princess, making difficult decisions that could risk uncountable lives, she's gladder than ever that she isn't one.
19. Aurora.
I don't remember, Queen Belcur had said in a whisper that wormed into Aurora's chest and made it ache with cold. It was real. It had to have been. It means something, she's sure. Aurora slips out the Blackthorn Gate, closing it with a quiet creak behind her. She doesn't want to wake anyone, but especially not Heath. He looked so young when she'd stared down at his sleeping form a few minutes ago, lying on the rug beside the smoking orange embers that had been the small fire in his study. And far away, too, like she was looking not at him, but at a reflection of him in a body of water, wavering, rippling. She didn't want to lie to him. Somehow this, taking his maps and notes and sneaking out while he sleeps, seemed better. So, she thinks as she makes her way across the dewy fields, the Queen is too mad to have any answers. Madness is not uncommon among the Fae. 200 years ago, the North Fairy had been an expert chess player and a brilliant scholar of astronomy and philosophy before her mind began to play chess with itself and left her frail, blithering and wild-eyed. A great tragedy, considering her tithe had been logic. By the time she was murdered, she had long since lost her powers and her ability to rule, except in name. But maybe Aurora can help Belcur remember why she made this place, and for whom she has been waiting all these years, for someone to free her. Aurora has laid awake night after night, thinking about the profound sadness, even fear, she heard in the Queen's voice. The way out of here is not, she senses, a logical one at all, but an emotional one. The clue she keeps clinging to is the image of the hand-woven cottage, with the steaming teacup in the window that, and the distinct sense Aurora had when viewing the tapestries that every scene was in some way a representation of a piece of the real world. There must be some reason behind Belcur's choices. If Sommet is a warped version of her world, then perhaps, Aurora thinks, the answer to how to get out lies in understanding the differences between the two. For the first time, Aurora realizes that being an outsider could mean she, unlike the others here, can unravel this mystery. And besides, she knows she won't be able to look Heath in the eyes again until she has proven herself to him. Though the night fell rapidly, dawn now approaches with an agonizing slowness, the white lip of the horizon quivering. Aurora focuses on that pale line in the distance. Even though it's risky, even though it means heading back alone into the borderlands, she has decided to look for the cottage again. If Belcur was expecting someone to arrive there, it must be important. If she were home, she knows, Isby would scold her for going so far without her. She misses arguing with Isby. She misses everything about Isby. She can hardly think she misses her so much. The land is barren. Everything parched, trees reaching naked branches up into the sky, where one by one the stars sacrifice themselves to the coming day. Abandoned farmhouses dot her peripheral vision, rotten wood silvered in the faint glow of dawn. Aurora can't shake the feeling that everything here shifts or blinks or wanes just slightly when she's not looking directly at it. And then she's entering the forest, which still contains a last sigh of night, musky and chill. Aurora pulls her hood back over her head. She does not like nighttime in Sommet. It reminds her too much of childhood, when darkness meant the end of playtime and the beginning of dreams. Haunting, changeable, when she'd sometimes hear the coughing of plague victims even from her high tower room, and wake the next morning to find more of the palace staff had been carted off with the dawn. The night here is thick as a wool cloak that once belonged to her mother. It almost smells like the cloak too, and the floral perfume the Queen loved to wear. It is the smell of sadness and smallness and fear. She finds the wall, or rather, it finds her. One moment mist seems to knit the trees together, then it's as if the fog has solidified to stone in all directions. She takes a deep breath and begins to move along the wall, wondering how she'll find the rift, especially if the rift is always in a different place. The challenge seems nearly impossible. And yet Heath finds his way through it every single day. She pulls out his scrawled pages of maps and charts, but try as she might, she can't interpret them. Restless, she refolds them and resigns herself to inching along the wall, using her hands to feel for variations. Once again, she feels the essence of the stones, but their story has no beginning, middle, and end. It's more like a song, a sequence of dark, swirling emotions on a continuous loop. It scares her, this vastness, this trappedness. She pulls her hands away, tempted to turn around and race back to Blackthorn, but then she thinks of the disappointment in Heath's eyes during their argument, and she knows she can't. Someone needs to solve the mystery of this place. What if she really is the only one who can piece it together? Besides, she can't risk never returning home to see her sister, or to meet the Prince of Arbin, or to unify the kingdoms against Malfleur. Her whole life is back in Delus, and she needs to be where her life is. She begins to sing to herself, surprised by how soothing it is to hear her own voice echoed back to her as she runs her fingers over bumps and cracks and sections of stone so smooth they seem to whisper of peace. The rose lullaby comes to her as she walks. One night reviled, before break of morn, amid the roses wild, all tangled in thorns, the shadow and the child together were born. The bright sun did spin, the moon swallowed day, when one her dear twin forever did slay. As the lyrics leave her lips, something changes beneath her hands. The wall begins to soften, to give. Could she have found the rift so soon? She stops singing and the wall is once again impenetrable. She backtracks but can't find the spot again. She stares at the stones for a second, and then something occurs to her. She tries singing the lullaby again, and the wall bends inward, rippling like a body of water. She sings louder, and as she does, she steps forward, and forward, and through. At first, the borderlands do not appear threatening, and she wonders if Heath has overstated their dangers. The sun breaks open, lighting up a thousand shades of green in the canopy above her. Birds dart between branches, chirruping. Fresh pine cones crunch beneath her shoes. After several steps, Aurora turns quickly, but the wall is still visible. She breathes out in relief, then gets an idea. She pulls the necklace of rubies and pearls out of her cloak pocket. One by one, she removes the jewels. She bends down and leaves one at the base of a tree. Then she moves deeper into the forest. Every 10 feet or so, she lays down another, leaving a glimmering trail. As long as there's enough light to see by, she'll be able to trace her way back to the wall. But by the time she comes to the end of the necklace, she has seen no variation in the woods and no sign of the location of the cottage. She once again unfolds Heath's maps and stares at them in confusion. Should she go back or continue on without a trail to retrace? She turns in a circle, surveying the area. The idea of moving in the wrong direction makes her pulse spike with nervousness. She walks a few more paces, thinking there might be a clearing ahead. Yes, just there, through the thicket, she picks up her pace, trying to outrace the fear that lurks just behind her, threatening to break like a wave over her head. But panic begins to seize her chest, and she's reminded of losing her way in Delus and stumbling upon the cottage, and then the spinning wheel that transported her here to Samay in the first place. She's suddenly dizzy with the idea that it could happen again, that she may be doomed to fall through one strange version of the world into another and another and another, like a series of marred reflections, until there's no longer any hope of finding herself. There is no clearing. It had been a trick of the light. The worry is a whirl of wind in her ears, a stir of leaves overhead, a shivering. She is a child again, so very afraid of the many things she cannot understand, of the things she'll never be able to say. Aurora grabs onto the bark of a tree, the fear making it hard to breathe. She wants to cry. She wants to be held. She wants to be saved. But no one is here to save her. She takes a heaving breath. Isby, she taps into the side of the tree in their old language, in her truest language. I can't do this alone. Another wind snakes through the branches, rustling the leaves. A twig snaps. And Aurora knows. She's not alone. She blinks into the brush, which stirs again. A set of eyes emerge, several carriage lengths away, and pointed white-grey ears. Wolf. Her heart lurches into her throat. She can't move. It's not common, she knows, for wolves to stalk in broad daylight. Then again, if there's little game, perhaps they too are starving, drawn out of their natural habits by the smell of flesh. Aurora trembles and backs up slightly. In response, the wolf makes a jerky movement, as though about to leap from the underbrush. She freezes again, trying to recall what to do in the presence of wild predators. But all she can think of is the romance of Ulrika, abandoned as a baby in a wolf's den, where she was raised for 16 years before the valiant and dashing Prince Bertram discovered her and made her his wife. Ulrika could never sleep in the luxury of the palace. She would lope into the mountains, howling. One night, the prince followed his love and watched her transform into a wolf in the pale glow of the moon. He cried out in shock. Then his love turned on him and sank her fangs into his neck. Aurora looks at the wolf's eyes, and then she turns and runs. Sprinting through the forest, she hears the wolf tracking her, gaining on her. Her pulse is nearly deafening, her breath burns in her chest. The forest is too dense. She can't dodge the low-hanging branches quickly enough. She swears she can feel the heat of the animal's breath at her heels now. It's too late. She'll never outrun. She trips over a tree's roots and flies forward onto her hands and knees, a startled sob of pain bursting from her throat. Quickly she rolls to her side, ready to greet death face to face, when a blur of brown dives across the corner of her vision. A young male deer in its prime. The hart bounds high through the trees, the most graceful thing she's ever witnessed. And then the wolf lunges, and the deer is struck down. Aurora scrambles up even as the wolf bends over its writhing prey, so close to her she could almost touch it, can even feel the steam leaking from the deer's wound. The beautiful hart struggles, whimpering, kicking its legs as the wolf leans into the animal, tearing at its belly. There is blood streaking its body, covering the wolf's mouth messily, reminding her of the vivid lip color the night fairy wore. Tears sting Aurora's face. She runs. She can't be sure how long she has been running, when out of nowhere she reaches the cottage. She bursts inside, panting, then slams the door and falls to the floor to catch her breath. She made it. She lost the necklace, has no idea how to get back to Blackthorn, and is still deeply shaken from watching the wolf attack the deer moments before it would have attacked her. But somehow she made it here, to the place where Belle Kerr left out tea in anticipation of someone coming, though Aurora, apparently, was not the person the Queen had been expecting. She pushes herself back to her feet again, and finds the room with the table set for tea. She touches the fluffy-looking sugar. An insect scuttles out of the bowl. She shudders and pulls away, knocking over the teacup. Scalding water flies at her, and she sucks in a breath, stumbling backward. She understands now why the palace cooks at home always forbade her from coming near their boiling pots. Aurora's also certain now that Belle Kerr's tapestries somehow depict, or even control, Sommeil. The way the image of the steam over the teacup had seemed to waver. It must have been the Queen's way of making sure the actual tea would remain hot. But still, who was the tea left for? And why? Aurora continues to wander through the cottage. Though much seems to change, the location of doors and windows, the little chair she'd noticed the first time is still in the parlour room, facing the wall as it had before. It looks like a spot someone would send a child in trouble to sit for hours as punishment, she realizes. Curious, she approaches the chair, noticing grooves in the wall just above it. She bends down to look closer. Someone has etched words into the wood. Much of it is barely legible, caked in dust. A scattering of initials, perhaps, and code words. One entire phrase she's able to piece together, a limerick. The secret boy we almost kissed. He won my jewel in a game of whist. The words seem to ooze in and out of the wood, sometimes more prominent, then fading again. It gives Aurora a horrible feeling of uncertainty. The secret boy. This was a childhood crush. Her mind reels with the simplicity of it. Could the Queen have been waiting all these years for a lover to come rescue her? And the reference to the jewel, this reminds her of the necklace and the pearl that somehow unlocked one of the enchantments on the Forbidden Wing at Blackthorn. Why would a piece of jewelry have been so important to the Queen that it would, effectively, cut through her magic? If Belle Kerr had created this whole world and everything in it, why would she have created a necklace that that could do such a thing. But Belka didn't create everything. She didn't create Heath or Wren or any of the other living peasants. They were all descended from the original servants who worked for the Queen. They are just as real as Aurora. Something tingles in her chest. It's the feeling of discovery, of things slotting together like the strands of warp and weft on a loom. Her heart races, the tingling sparks into flame. Maybe the necklace came from the real world. Maybe, in that sense, the object itself is immune to the power of the Queen's dreams. The rose lullaby, too, comes from her world, and when she sang its lyrics, the wall opened for her. She's not sure what it means, but she has become certain of one thing. The key to getting out of Sommei is not going to lie in any pattern or any place you could mark on a map. It is going to lie in a story. A true story about Belkur and her secret love. The one to whom she lost her jewel. The missing bead on the necklace, Aurora guesses. No one knows romances better than Aurora does. Energized by this revelation, she moves back through the room toward the door with little difficulty until she steps outside. The forest is still, but Aurora has the oddest sensation that everything has rearranged itself. She thinks of her discovery. Items from the real world can shatter the spell of Sommei, can see their way through the illusions. Shouldn't Aurora herself then be able to see clearly, to shake the cloudiness from her mind, to navigate the changing landscape? She tries to concentrate, but the velvety strangeness of the air itself continues to ebb and flow within her, infecting her thoughts. Of course it makes a peculiar sort of sense that objects might be impervious to illusions in a way that people are not. People are susceptible. She is susceptible. She takes a deep breath and begins singing the rose lullaby again. It seems to help. The trees don't move. No wolves appear. She steps into the woods as confidently as she can. After only a few repetitions, she sees a parting of the trees, and between them, a steep riverbed. A harsh, rocky cliff juts out, dropping down about 30 or 40 feet into a dried-up ravine. Perhaps she can climb to the top for a better vantage point. As she hurries toward it, she can almost hear the former waterfall in its heavy silence, a dull and constant roar. Sickly moss still clings to some of the stones, indicating the stream that once flowed freely here. Aurora can picture what it must have looked like, water tumbling over the ledge and sparkling in the sun. One of the boulders looks distinctly like a man's face. Her heart leaps. It looks just like the one she and Isby named for its odd shape years and years ago in the stream that runs just past the cattle pastures beyond the palace of Deluce. Nose Rock. She runs toward the riverbed. This is no different from climbing the palace towers with Isby, she tells herself as she reaches the rocks and looks for a foothold. For a moment, she could swear she hears Isby's voice calling out to her from far away. Hurry, Aurora, she's saying, before they find us. In her memory, she and Isby are on the roof, searching for a spot to hide from angry council members. Aurora is both nervous about getting in trouble and filled with Isby's contagious joy. But this isn't a game. Her heart beats hard in her ribs as she reaches hand over hand, beginning to climb. 20. Belkur, the Night Fairy.
Someone's coming, sweet pea.
The queen bursts into the throne room, her heart full of crow's wings, beating, beating.
Sweet pea!
Belkur nearly trips over the lace of her floor-length gown as she turns a full circle. Her crown weighs heavy on her head. Has her sweet pea gone off? Another one vanished. She drops to her knees, searching. She would pray, but the Fae don't believe in such things.
There you are.
Relief is a burst of sunshine in her chest. She can breathe again as she retrieves sweet pea from beneath the throne, running her fingers along its hand-carved name. The hairbrush, her favorite, for its silver filigree and gentle teeth, must have fallen. But what is this? Caught in its furry mouth. The queen extracts a large clump of thin white strands, like frayed threads or giant cobwebs.
Sweet pea, she whispers, horrified. What have you eaten?
She'll have to have everything cleaned. The castle must be spotless.
We must be ready. Someone is coming. Haven't I told you?
She calls for the courier, who scurries in. Have there been no deliveries? She demands.
Your Majesty, no,
he replies helplessly. She stares at him hard, watching his hairy ears twitch and his tiny hands tremble. Then he tucks his head and scampers away. Belkhir is certain she sees the tail of a mouse darting through the doorway behind him. She shudders. Things are slipping, slipping between the cracks, like a stream eddying helplessly through moss-damp rocks. She can't help but fear she has forgotten some important detail. She hastens to her hall of tapestries and walks up and down its length, studying her creations, looking for an answer. She pauses next to an image of a little riverbed bent over a ledge where a rock juts out, nose-like, over the rest. Why has the river gone dry? That's not how it should be. That's not, she's certain, what her visitor would want. All of her dreams ready to be dashed in an instant if things don't go precisely as planned. Her pulse stutters, a broken metronome. It's wrong, all wrong. She has made some vital mistake. Desperately, she reaches out and claws at the tapestry. Her nails snag. The ravine becomes an angry gash, revealing a wide flow of loose, unwoven blues and greys. The miniature silk river pours forth. It floods. 21. Aurora. 1 minute she was clambering across the parched ravine, then all at once the stream came alive, spurting over the ledge above, forming a real waterfall, its current so strong it swept Aurora instantly off her feet and sent her swirling into an ever-deepening, ever-quickening whirlpool, swishing downriver faster, faster. She kicks her legs and flaps her arms, trying to keep her head above water, thinking of fair Alcyone, who fell in love with the morning star, and in her grief, drowned. Aurora had adored that story, back when it had only been one of many myths to read and savor, before she understood what it might really feel like to lose someone. The river engulfs her. She feels its longing, its loss. And the truth about Samae flows through her, clear and crisp as the river. Even as Aurora moves with the current, she is buoyed by this new certainty. Belkhir isn't trapped here at all, but she retreated to this place, both of solace and loneliness, not unlike Aurora's own tower room back in Deleuze. Aurora remembers the starling, the one that possessed dark fairy magic and could speak, the one that taunted her for being a caged bird. She's been so blind to think she was a prisoner of circumstances, that it was her lack of voice, a jealous fairy bargain, that held her back all these years. Really, it has always been her own obedience, her desire to please, to do everything right, to follow instead of lead, that has stopped her from truly living. The thought urges her to kick harder, with more confidence. She is not just swimming towards safety now, but away from her former, meeker self. She can almost hear the wail of the old Aurora, weak and scared, carried downstream, far away. She has finally made it to the shore when she hears a distant sound. There is someone wailing. She looks back to the river, madly rushing on its course. There's someone else out there. A little girl. She can hear her crying. She can hear her screaming. Aurora races downstream along the muddy banks. A young girl is thrashing and struggling in the waves. Without thinking, Aurora plunges back into the cold water and drags the little girl to shore by the collar of her blue dress, one arm wrapped under her armpits. By the time she pulls her up onto the riverbank, she's shaking and exhausted. But the girl, who can only be around 5 or 6 years old, seems oddly unfazed. The child stands up, smiling.
Roses are red, violets are blue. Children behave, and so should you. She says, her hands on her hips, her eyes black and blazing.
She's apparently unaware that she's drenched, her dark, shoulder-length hair tangled and wet.
"Where's your mother?" Aurora asks, catching her breath. "You shouldn't be playing by the river all alone." I'm looking for violets, the girl declares. Roses are red, violets are... Do you live at Blackthorn? What's your name?
The girl shrugs.
Daisy? Daisy, I need violets.
The girl clasps her hands together.
Violets for the tea party. Violets are blue. Children behave, and so should you.
She begins to skip ahead, then turns back as if remembering Aurora is there.
You help me, right? I can't go home without the flowers.
Daisy, Aurora says. That must be the girl's name.
You need to tell me where you live, so I can bring you home.
The girl cocks her head, blinking.
Violets are blue, roses are red, evil will reign when the fairies are dead.
Aurora shivers, even though the sun is burning hard, drying her off.
You like rhymes?
The girl nods.
I'm the best at puzzles. Will you help me?
Aurora bends down so she's at her level.
How can I help you?
Do you live near here?
The girl's eyes wander as though she's trying to remember.
I think so.
Why don't you show me which way you came? Your mother must be so worried.
My mother?
She barks out a surprised laugh.
Will you help me find violets? We must have violets for the tea party. Tea is black, milk is white. Naughty children are thrashed at night.
Now there are tears in the girl's eyes.
You're not going to leave, are you? Please don't leave me.
She grabs on to Aurora's hands.
I'll never find them in time.
Even through her tears, her voice drops low.
The tea party will be ruined.
Suddenly the girl runs ahead, darting into the woods. Aurora's pulse hammers.
Daisy! Come back here!
She starts to run after her.
Daisy! Slow down!
She stops running and turns in a full circle, trying to get her bearings. The river has disappeared. Her neck feels hot.
Daisy!
She calls out. Then she hears the girl muttering to herself and heaves a sigh of relief as her head bobs back into view. She'd been crawling through tall grass nearby.
Daisy, 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 the little girl says to herself. Where's Daisy?
You're Daisy, Aurora says, though anxiety rustles back up through her chest.
You're Daisy,
the girl repeats. Then her face changes.
No, Daisy is baking the cherry tarts. Peach for a pudding, cherry for a tart. Nothing tastes sweet to a broken heart.
Belclair, too, had spoken of cherry tarts.
Are you Daisy or not?
The girl looks at her.
I'm Marigold.
Aurora sighs. Either the girl is being purposefully defiant, or just playing some sort of game, or... Of course. The girl is an impression, like Heath told her about. Beside her, Marigold, if that is the girl's name, has been plucking wildflowers and knotting them into a small crown, discarding the buds that displeased her.
There,
she says happily, putting the finishing touches on it and then placing the crown on her head.
Now I am the queen, and you must obey me, she exclaims, then bends forward, giggling.
Aurora feels a chill. It looks like the girl is, somehow, flickering. She blinks and shakes her head. Once again, the child is solid before her.
Marigold is naughty, the girl says. Daisy is nice. For goodness does not strike the same nest twice.
Once again, her rhyme sends a shiver through Aurora. All of her limericks have a dark side.
Goodness doesn't strike the same nest twice. What does that mean, exactly?
Marigold looks up at her, and once again, her face seems to flutter, like a moth's wings against a lantern. White, light, white, light, white, light. It must be a trick of the sun setting behind the trees, but it leaves an unsettling feeling in Aurora's gut.
One night so mild, the girl responds. Before break of morn, amid the roses wild, all tangled in thorns. The shadow and the child together. Were born.
One night so mild.
It's the rose lullaby, Aurora says, but the way it starts is one night reviled.
Where did you learn that?
Marigold shrugs again.
I didn't learn it. We made it up.
You?
But Aurora stares at her. Everyone knows the lullaby is about Malfleur and Belcur.
The shadow and the child.
Who is this girl?
Marigold,
she says, squatting down. She wraps her hands around the girl's arms, gently but firmly.
Do you have a sister?
Marigold cocks her head and thinks for a second. Then she nods. But as she nods, she once again begins to change, morph, fade, like a flame guttering. Even her arms seem like they are turning into ether under Aurora's touch. She yanks her fingers away, unexpectedly scalded. Her fingertips have been burned pink.
Marigold,
she blurts out, startled. But the girl is ghosting into nothingness before her eyes.
Marigold!
Daisy, Daisy, Daisy,
the girl sings, her voice faltering.
Daisy is as Daisy does.
Who are you?
Mary's a falcon, Daisy's a dove. One of us is flying high, high above,
the girl says, pointing to the sky. Aurora squints up and sees a bird careering through amber ribbons of light and shadow. Night is approaching hungrily, rising up from the horizon like a dark tide. The bird darts into it, consumed. When Aurora turns back, the girl has vanished. On the ground where she stood lies the floral crown. 22. Isabel. Isby's good mood has soured quickly. She actually felt restored after her much-needed bath and having slept in a bed just as thick and soft as the ones in the palace where she grew up. Even if her dreams were marred by a haunting melody, equal parts whale song and lullaby, even if she'd been up half the night contemplating how best to convince the prince to help her. She'd slept in his private guest quarters and been awakened by Elise. When she inquired about the prince, however, the maid told her that he'd gone for an early ride.
He enjoys getting out while the sun is just rising, the woman had said fondly.
Off on a riding excursion, when they've only just agreed that the safety of both their kingdoms is at stake. That was more than an hour ago. Isby is still pacing and exploring the room, tense as an arbalist about to lose its bolt. When the maid returns again and clears her throat, Isby whips around to face her.
The prince has asked that you wait for him in the music chamber, she announces.
She leads Isby down a corridor, then up a wide, winding staircase to a room flooded with the warmth of sunlight from every direction. A tower room, then. Curious, Isby feels her way around the room after the maid leads her there. She wonders if the prince himself is fond of playing instruments. Her fingers trace over the keys of a clavichord. Her sister knows how to play both the clavichord and harpsichord beautifully. Isby, on the other hand, never had the patience for it, though she enjoys listening. Maybe this is a sign that William will make the perfect husband for Aurora. Maybe her plan will work.
Do you believe in natural talent? The prince asks, entering the room on a draft of fresh air.
He smells like lime and saddle. The latter reminds her of Gilbert. Isby turns toward him.
I believe in a lack thereof.
He laughs, his curt laugh. Exactly. I'd like to think we aren't born one way or another, that one can become accomplished at anything with enough practice, but that has not been the case with me and stringed instruments, despite devoting many hours a week to the cause.
So perhaps he wouldn't be wooing Aurora by song any time soon, she thinks.
It's as though my hands are somehow too literal, he explains, his footsteps on the marble floor echoing closer. I can play the notes in roughly the correct rhythm, but the music lacks whatever it is that makes music enjoyable.
Flow? Ease? Isby replies, recalling the many times her sister has played and the way the music transported her. The feeling that the sound has sprung up spontaneously from some natural source.
Precisely. Let me show you something, he says, offering her his arm.
Isby allows the prince to guide her to a corner of the room and seat her in a chair facing a small round table. She puts out her hands to feel what's on the surface. There are small items arranged like a chess set, made from something smooth and cold, possibly ivory. Narwhal tusk, she thinks.
It's a model, William explains.
He sits on the other side of the table and places her hands delicately on one piece at a time.
These are our warships. This is our cavalry.
The objects are beautifully and intricately carved.
Each rider has a horse, and each horse has a mane that blows slightly differently in an invisible breeze.
Did you make these? She asks in wonder.
I did. And this, he adds, this is something I've been working on. He guides her hand over a small item, oblong and angled.
What is it?
A cannon. But not just any cannon. This one contains missiles filled with oil. It's more dangerous, but more effective, because it spreads fire more rapidly across enemy lines.
She runs her fingers over the model. It's cracked, she notices.
Philip wasn't impressed by the idea. He said oil was too expensive.
Isby imagines the prince's older brother throwing the cannon models on the floor in derision as she moves her hand back to the warships, feeling the delicacy with which their sails were carved, wondering what William is getting at.
Isabel of Deleuze, I'll do my best to help you and your sister.
Wait, what?
Even if she doesn't awaken, William goes on, we can certainly arrange for a marriage announcement. No one will have to know the difference. Arben is almost as good as Deleuze at covering up a scandal.
The idea that Aurora may never recover causes Isby's guts to twist. But this is good news. He will help her. Why? What made you decide?
William sighs. I do know what it's like to lose a sibling, Isabel. Even one not as beloved as yours is to you. I've lost two. It's like a lantern sputtering out in a dark tunnel. There are times when I think about how I'm going to lead Arben into a brighter future, and I am overwhelmed by the impossibility of it.
He pauses.
You know, I used to love looking at the stars at night. I used to think they were put there to guide us. Now I know they are just watching and winking, mute observers, bemused by our failures and our loss.
She has never heard anyone talk this way before, of stars and of loss. How can the man who sculpted such meticulous objects out of ivory, who speaks so rhapsodically about the night sky, be the same man who rudely knocked her to the floor when he first saw her, the man who deeply insulted her kingdom and its people?
She never spent much time thinking about the personalities of the Arbinian princes. Most of her and Aurora's gossip had been about their looks and reputations. But she's beginning to feel that William is contradictory and strange, with his velvet cloak, with his smell of lime, with his swaying tree voice and his slamming door laugh.
But he has a heart, he must, for he seems moved by her desire to save Aurora.
Moved enough to help.
So you'll come with me to Deleuze, and you'll help me establish the alliance, Isby says carefully.
I will, but there are conditions, he adds.
Which are?
We need your oil.
His statement lands heavy as a boulder, so it isn't empathy that's convinced him. His decision is tactical. He wants Deleuzian oil for his fancy cannon design. Anticipating her next question, he goes on.
Like I said, we're an efficient country. We spent all of our money on warships, not on whaling vessels. We could accrue our own sources of oil, but not as quickly as we would need if we are to implement these weapons in time.
Isby swallows. She imagines the narwhal that narrowly freed itself from the harpoon, spinning through the darkness of the North Sea, its tusk pointing the way like a glowing sword, the bloody wound in its shoulder reddening the waters as it dives. And she knows there are far larger, far greater beasts of the sea that have died and must die in order to provide all of Deleuze's oil. But then she thinks of Gil, promising his luck away to Binks for information. For her.
What's your answer, then? The prince asks. Shall we stand on the same side of this war?
Isby takes a breath, then holds out her hand for him to shake. You have a deal. She had almost forgotten what it feels like to enter or exit through an actual door. Isby turns her face to the sun now, blinking, taking in its distant warmth. The new cloak William gave her smells fresh and clean, like the winter air that whispers along the bare part of her neck as she allows the prince to lead her, arm in arm, through the palace gates. When William told her over a breakfast of warm bread, salted fish and bubbling, runny eggs, that it would be a danger to travel under his banner, that he'd be a moving target after the death of his brothers,
she suggested they dress as peasants and journey as husband and wife. But the prince dismissed the idea. The ports are still closed. If I issue an order to reopen them, it will draw attention to our departure,